me add my welcome to Catherine's. Thank you, Hannah, for reading for us. Thank you, Catherine, for praying for us. We do need God's help as we come to God's Word. I always find sermon introductions hard. The point of them, I'm told, is to grab the congregation's attention so that they listen to what I have to say. A good joke or illustration, asking an interesting question, apparently that's the secret to keeping people with you. I guess the point is that first impressions matter, even in sermons. It's a principle that you see everywhere. Think of the musical that begins with a big opening number. First impressions matter. Or the political campaign that begins with the choreographed appearance, the well-rehearsed speech. First impressions make or break a leader's campaign. So what then, you've got to wonder, is Jesus doing? As we've just heard read, this is the first miracle he performs, and everything is wrong. He's in the wrong place. He's in Cana, a backwater of the ancient world, the Wolverhampton of Jesus' day. I should have told a joke. He's in a backwater of the ancient world. If he wants to make a big first impression, he's in the wrong place. And he's chosen the wrong miracle, hasn't he? I wonder what you would have started with. Maybe a miraculous healing, a curing of leprosy, walking on water, raising the dead. And yet, he begins with this, water into wine at a party. Why does Jesus start like this, with a party trick? And what, for that matter, does John think he's doing? If you were here last week, you'll have heard how John put together this book of 9 signs to convince us that Jesus is the Christ, the rescuer, and the Son of God. John picks just his top 9 most persuasive miracles. So why pick this one? And why not get on to chapter 4, the healing of a dying boy? More than that, why does Jesus think this miracle in particular reveals Jesus' glory, as he says in verse 11? Well, we find the answer comes when we see what this sign points to. As you said last week, the miracles in John aren't there just to break up the dialogue. They're not there to wow us with Jesus' power. Instead, they're signs. They're miracles that point us to Jesus, to his work for us. In this case, the miracle is meant to show us Jesus' glory as the Messiah. But before we get on to that, I want to say a thing or two about miracles. Perhaps if you're here and you're not a Christian, the idea of miracles is a hard one to swallow. Maybe you think us Christians are a strange, irrational, unscientific bunch of people to take John literally. Maybe you're a Christian here, but miracles still trouble you. You find talking about Jesus in the staff room or the office difficult because people laugh at the idea of someone actually performing miracles. Maybe you're a student and the idea of handing out gospels during a mission week makes you feel a little bit nervous. Couldn't we choose something without miracles for people to read? Might they not take that a bit more seriously? Well, I guess lots of us will have heard the argument that goes something like this. People believed in miracles in the old days because they didn't know that miracles were contrary to the laws of nature. And so they go on to say, well, of course, nowadays we do know the laws of nature, and so we can rule out the possibility of miracles. It sounds persuasive. But of course, as C.S. Lewis pointed out, people in the old days knew just as well as us the laws of nature. Here's a quote. If Joseph didn't know that a virgin birth was contrary to nature, in other words, if he didn't know the normal origin of babies, why, on discovering his wife's pregnancy, was he minded to divorce her quietly? Obviously, no event would be recorded as a wonder unless the recorders knew the natural order and saw this as an exception. If people didn't know that the sun rose in the east, they wouldn't be even interested at its once rising in the west. They would not record it as a miracle, nor indeed record it at all. The very idea of a miracle presupposes knowledge of the laws of nature. You can't have the idea of an exception until you have the idea of a rule. So you see how the idea that people in olden times were gullible, how that argument doesn't stand up. People say Jesus' followers believed in miracles because they didn't know the law of physics. In fact, they believed in Jesus' miracles despite knowing the laws of physics. That, I suggest, begs an explanation. It's also worth saying that it wasn't just Jesus' followers who thought that he'd perform miracles. I was interested to read recently, even Jesus' enemies concede that. If you read the Jewish attacks on Christians from the first century, they focus on trying to discredit Jesus. And what you might expect them to do is to try and show that he didn't really perform miracles. And yet nobody tries that. Instead, they accuse him of having gone to Egypt and learnt magic there. Their problem was that in the first century, there were lots of eyewitnesses around who'd seen Jesus perform miracles. Many of them were performed in front of large crowds, and there were loads of eyewitnesses around. It was only long after those generations had died out that no one ever thought of trying to deny the fact that Jesus had performed miracles. So I want to suggest that as we come to look at this miracle, there is at least good reason to keep an open mind. The idea that people like John were gullible and ignorant of scientific laws is patronizing to John, and historically it doesn't fit the facts. So I hope that at least we'll keep an open mind as we come not just to think about the miracle, but about what it tells us about Jesus. In fact, I hope as we see what the miracle tells us about Jesus, we might even have reason to want the miracle to be true. As I've looked at this passage, I think the thing that struck me is how just about every detail points us to Jesus' glory, to his work as our Messiah, our rescuer. And so we're going to look at just the three main elements of the miracle and let them point us on to Jesus' glory. We'll look at the water, the wine, and the wedding. First, the water, verse 6. John says, "Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing." And these were probably stood in the courtyard of the house, and they were used whenever you came to eat to wash your hands to be clean. The law of the Old Testament set out countless ways in which Jews needed to be kept ritually clean, ceremonially clean, in order to be able to worship God. To be unclean wasn't the same as to be sinful, but God gave Jews the idea of cleanness and uncleanness as a big illustration of sin. The whole system was designed to show that it's impossible to remain free from guilt, and that cleansing is needed if we're going to have any kind of relationship with God. But the obvious problem with this answer was that it was temporary at best. Washing with water made you ceremonially unclean again, and then made you ceremonially clean, and then you become unclean again. Every mealtime, even here at a wedding, was another reminder, I need to be clean. The point was that we need cleansing from sin, and there was nothing available in that time to take its stain away for good. Washing after washing happened. Now I realise that we're using unfashionable language. These days we don't talk much about guilt and sin and moral responsibility. But I want to suggest that what the Bible says to us about sin, our uncleanness, it does strike a chord with us. As much as we're taught these days to blame our faults on our genes or our parents, we know that our faults are still our faults. When we do something stupid, we don't blame our genes. We say, sorry. We know there are blots on our records, and we know that it will take more than water to shift them. We recognise the truth of what God was teaching Israel. We don't live how we ought to, and we need to be made clean. And that's why Jesus turning water into wine should excite us tonight. By turning that water for ceremonial cleansing into something else, he's saying, you don't need it anymore. You don't need to keep going through those rituals. The miracle is a sign that points to Jesus as the glorious Messiah who takes away guilt and uncleanness. The miracle is a picture of what John said about Jesus in chapter 1, verse 17. The law, said John, was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. John's saying something new is here. The law is being put away and a new thing is happening. Instead of trying and failing to keep a clean sheet with God, Jesus brings God's grace, a free gift, a new way to be clean, a kind of cleansing that works. Which means the old ways can be put aside. The jars aren't needed for water anymore. And as you go through John's Gospel, Jesus spells it out for us more and more clearly. In chapter 13, referring to his death, Jesus says to Peter, "Unless I wash you, you have no part of me." Speaking of his death, Jesus thought that his death made Peter clean. Chapter 15, verse 3, Jesus says to his disciples, "You are already clean because of the word I've spoken to you." By putting our trust in Jesus, by recognizing him as our rescuer, we can be made clean. And let's be clear what we're talking about here. When John says that Jesus replaces the law as the way to be clean before God, he's not saying
that Jesus is just a new, better, slightly improved version of what was there before. The difference between the law and Jesus is not the difference between your Aldi economy washing powder and Persil Automatic stain-removing whiter whites powder. The difference between them isn't just that Jesus did what the law does, but better and faster. Now, Jesus does what the law was never able to do, and God never meant for it to do. Jesus cleanses our hands and our minds and our hearts, and he keeps them clean. Just as God promised, our scarlet sins are washed whiter than snow. So that's how the water points us to the glory of Jesus. It shows us a new way to be cleansed, no need for the old rituals. Well, what about turning water into wine, particularly? What does that say about Jesus' glory? How does it show that he's the rescuer that God promised? Well, the Old Testament has a surprising amount to say about wine. It often refers to it in a couple of situations. When people are under God's judgment, we're told about the wine supplies. Here's an example from Isaiah. The earth is defiled by its people. The new wine dries up and the vine withers. All the merrymakers groan. The gaiety of the tambourines is stilled. The noise of the revelers has stopped. The joyful harp is silent. No longer do they drink wine with a song. The beer is bitter to its drinkers. The ruined cities lie desolate. The entrance to every house is barred. In the streets they cry out for wine. So to be without wine is a picture of suffering the effects of sin, of being under God's judgment. But the Old Testament also talks about wine in the context of forgiveness and restoration. Here's an example of that from Amos chapter 9. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the ploughman and the planter by the one treading grapes. New wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills. I will bring back my exiled people, Israel. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will plant vineyards and drink their wine. They will make gardens and eat their fruit. I will plant Israel in their own land, never again to be uprooted from the land I have given them, says the Lord your God. So you see how God promises to forgive his people, take away his judgment, to make them secure and prosperous, to give them a secure relationship with himself. And it's all pictured with wine. The fact that wine is going to be flowing from the hills, dripping from the mountains. It's a picture of abundance and provision and security, being able to enjoy the crops that you've planted. And all of that, I suggest, is background to what's going on in John. Jesus turns water into wine. It's a summary of all his work in one action. He does away with the law. He provides a new way for us to be clean. And he provides security for his people. What Amos looked forward to, forgiveness, restoration, peace with God, they're here. Jesus takes away our guilt and he brings celebration. He's the glorious Messiah who brings his people joy. That's what I love about this miracle. It doesn't just point to Jesus as someone who takes away people's guilt and then wants them to be a bit serious and a bit dull. Jesus has come to create a joyful people, a people who celebrate. That's why John tells us exactly how much wine we're talking about here. 6 jars, 20 to 30 gallons each, let's say 25 gallons. That's 72 cases, 870 bottles of wine for this party. It's not an invitation to an almighty knees up. It's a sign that the days that Amos looked forward to have arrived. Jesus' death richly and abundantly provides for his people. A secure relationship with God is on offer. And please let's notice how opposite this is to the way that we're taught to think about Jesus. I'm sure every one of us recognises the idea of Christianity being about being a good boy or a good girl, keeping your nose clean, trying not to have too much fun. Becoming a Christian, we're told, it is the end of fun. Jesus doesn't bring joy, he takes it away. Maybe if you're not a Christian here, maybe that's what stops you from taking Jesus more seriously. Not so much troubled about the miracles, but the idea of just not being able to do what you want anymore. The idea of having to become a miserable Christian. But the point is, Jesus gives us a sort of joy that can't be found anywhere else. As we saw in Amos, what's on offer is a relationship unlike anything else. A relationship of complete security and confidence. In The Guardian, there's a running series of articles called What I Know About Men and What I Know About Women. and women write what I know about men, and men are invited to write what I know about women. I think probably the men's columns are shorter. I was reading recently, Denise Van Outen was telling us what she knows about men. The first thing that she wrote, she said, when I was younger, I wish I'd known that 90% of men are cheats. Now, that's a sad thing to hear, isn't it? I guess our own interpretation of the statistics would be different. But relationships don't offer us the sort of security that we look for. Jesus offers us something quite different. For a Christian, our relationship with God becomes the center of our security, so that whatever else may fail, our health, our families, even our relationships, but this relationship with God will not change, will not be taken away. It means that Christians can have joy even when the rest of life is tough. See, if you're not a Christian, you don't have that. At the middle of your life will be your relationship or your hope of future success in your career, and all of those things may be taken away from you. There's no confidence for the future. Christians have a confidence in a secure, lasting relationship with God that this wine symbolizes for us. So if you're rejecting Jesus tonight, don't let it be for this reason. Don't be fooled into thinking that he wants to take away your joy. So Jesus has not just come to make us clean, but to make us joyful. That's the significance of water being turned into wine. Hopefully we're starting to glimpse the glory of Jesus in this miracle. Water, wine. Let's thirdly think about wedding for a moment. And here's where we're going. Jesus is the glorious bridegroom who will make his people's joy complete. The important thing to realize is that when Jesus provides wine, he puts himself in the role of the bridegroom in this situation. You can see that in verse 10 when the groom gets the credit for the fine wine. In Jesus' day, the groom paid for the whole thing. He paid for the whole reception. And reception could last up to a week. Times wonderfully have changed. I'd still be paying the bills. It was the bridegroom's job to provide wine. And so when Jesus steps in to provide the wine, he's putting himself in the place of the bridegroom. In the next chapter, John will compare himself to a best man and Jesus to a bridegroom. And again, we're not going to understand the significance of these things until we go back to the Old Testament. Here's Isaiah 25. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove the disgrace of his people from all the earth. It's an image, you might recognize it, of tears being wiped away and so on, that gets picked up in Revelation. And there in Revelation 19, the feast is described as a wedding reception. The feast where God sets before his people at a feast, and it's a feast where Jesus is the groom. Heaven rejoices because the wedding of the Lamb, Jesus, has come. And John is told to write, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb. Okay, so let's put it together. In Isaiah, we've got a promise of a great feast where death and suffering are taken away. That points us to heaven, to that feast where the curses are taken away, death is no longer there, sin is taken away. And that is the wedding feast where Jesus is the bridegroom. And then in John chapter 2, we have Jesus in the role of groom, providing, just as Isaiah said, the finest of wines for his people. So it's a sign that points us beyond Jesus' death to heaven, to where Jesus fully and finally takes away our guilt, brings us joy, and one day makes our joy complete. In the new creation, Jesus will take away death and sin, and we will enjoy life to the full. It's not for nothing that John says Jesus reveals his glory in this chapter, when we understand how all these ideas point us forward. And before we finish, I want us to think a little bit more about joy. I expect for lots of us here, we're Christians, and we don't feel particularly joyful. We hear that Jesus has taken away our sin, he's removed our guilt and shame. Our relationship with God is no longer a matter of trying to be good enough. We know that it's true, but we don't feel joy. We're hard-pressed to remember the last time that we felt really joyful about the gospel. Now, there are lots of causes. We can have different doubts and distractions. But I want to suggest that the root of all of them is the fact that we don't believe in Jesus. Now, of course, in a sense, we do believe in Jesus. Now, if we're a Christian here, then we've believed in him and we're clean because of the word he's spoken to us. But we still need to believe. Our doubts and our distractions, they sap our joy because we haven't learned to believe in Jesus, to trust him fully. See, last week, Hugh pointed us to John's mission statement in writing his gospel there in chapter 20. John wrote about these signs so that we might believe in Jesus and that by believing we might have life in his name. And I guess it's tempting to think that the gospels then are just for people who haven't yet believed in Jesus. But I want us to see how this passage deepens our faith in Jesus in a way that takes away our doubts and our distractions. The gospel helps us believe in Jesus for the first time, and it helps us to keep believing. So for our doubts, I suppose we might think, if God is really there and as powerful as the Bible says, then does he really care about little old me and all the little concerns and doubts and fears that I have? Is he really interested in making me clean, in answering my prayers? Well, let this sign comfort you. Let it help you come to God with confidence and joy in the way that it shows us that God does care. John says in chapter 1, the Word became flesh. God himself came to this world in the person of his Son. And where does God go? Where does Jesus want to be? Well, here we find him at a wedding. It's not a high society wedding. It's not a royal wedding. Here is the divine in the domestic. And as we read through the gospel, we find Jesus in the company of immoral and excluded people. We see the divine with the dirty, with the depraved. God comes to earth in his Son and comes to people like you and me. And did you notice who Jesus reveals himself to in this passage? Who gets to glimpse Jesus' glory? The master of the banquet, the bride and the groom, the centers of attention, they don't get to see it. But his disciples and his servants see it. The master of the banquet has no idea, but Jesus reveals himself to whoever follows him, to whoever does what he says in the way that the servants do. They get to glimpse his glory. Here is God in a domestic backwater situation, not in Wolverhampton, in somewhere else obscure where you don't live. That is the sort of God that we have, the God who cares about these details, who saves the face of this bridegroom of running out of wine. Life's not being threatened in this situation, but still God works and his compassion extends to preserving the social standing of this couple. Maybe our debts arise from our sin. We know that Jesus offers to make us clean, but in the back of our mind are those things that we've done or we've thought, the ongoing struggles that we have with drink or ambition or pride or lust. And we think, if God really knows me inside out, then he must be having second thoughts about me. Ongoing sin makes us insecure and it makes us hesitant to pray. And so we can start trying to clean ourselves up before we come back to God. We turn wine back into water. If we haven't prayed for a while, then we come to God hesitantly or fearfully even. Maybe over Christmas, away from Christian friends, during the party season, we've made mistakes. And now we find ourselves at church and we're feeling a bit uncomfortable to be here. But God invites us to come joyfully. In his eyes, we've been made clean. Our relationship is secure. As we read in Amos, God has promised to bless us and never to uproot us again, never to turn us away. That's the relationship this miracle points to. We know it, but we find it hard to believe. And so we need to keep listening to John, even when we're reminded of our sin, if we're going to be a joyful people. I think just about my favourite description of the blessing that we have now as God's people, in Isaiah 12, he describes how in the day after Jesus has come, with joy you will draw from the wells of salvation. Isn't that a lovely picture? With joy you will draw from the wells of salvation. And as we feel conscious of our sin, we don't come hesitantly and fearfully. With joy we can draw from the wells of salvation and feel confidence and forgiveness for our sin. So John, here with this sign, helps us to believe in the face of our doubts. Finally, let me say something about how John helps us in the face of our distractions. Earlier this week, I heard news of a friend of mine from uni, and we were good friends at uni. We used to pray together quite regularly, and he used to play in the band at his church. Now he's living in London, he's working in television, and he's doing very well for himself, in a sense. Though he has no joy as a Christian. In fact, when he thinks of Jesus, I think probably he feels more resentment than joy. Now, how does that happen in the few short years after graduating? Well, to put it simply, he's been fooled. He stopped listening to John's gospel and he started listening to the world. John says, joy is to be found in Jesus, the security of a relationship with God and a future beyond imagining. The world says joy is to be found in relationships, in sex and success. And here's the thing, if you start believing that, then you won't see Jesus as the person who offers you joy. You'll start to resent him as the one you think is holding you back and not letting you enjoy what you want to. So beware of that. For others of us, I guess the distractions won't be so much the obvious temptations, but just all the stuff of life. I'm always finding this, and I've spoken to lots of you who feel the same way. You wake up, you have your quiet time, but then it's 10:30, your boss is being annoying again, the computer's crashed, the kids are writing on the walls, your shoulder's aching again, and you've lost it. I lose perspective in moments. I believe that Jesus offers me the most amazing thing, a relationship with God. I believe that that's what I have. But still, all those littlest things cast a shadow over my day. There's a complete lack of perspective. And the point is, I think, that we have control over our joy. During our day, instead of letting all those things cloud our thinking and make us joyless, we need to let John's signs restore a bit of perspective. Even the things that I know cast big clouds over our lives, relationships breaking up, boredom in your job, broken families, they're painful, but they shouldn't make us joyless. We believe the message of this passage, but we don't really believe it. We need to believe it again. At work, things are frustrating. Well, let's say to ourselves during the day, water, wine, wedding, let's try to remember some of those blessed things that they point to. At tea and coffee, let's share with each other what we most often lose perspective over. What is it that causes us most to be joyless by 10:30? Let's resolve to encourage each other with those things. So let's not be easily distracted. Lastly, of course, I realise some of the stuff of life is not so trivial. The elderly relative, 100 miles away, whose health is declining and he's visiting regularly. The bereavements that just grieve us year after year. I know those things are hard, but there should still be room for joy. We have a firm, unshakable relationship with God. Jesus is the glorious Messiah who one day will complete our joy. One day we'll be with him at the feast with the finest of wines. When death is defeated, tears are wiped away. Let's pray.